I'm Divya Shekhar, and this is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. On the last episode of From the Bookshelves, we heard former Procter & Gamble India CEO Gurcharan Das say that while India got political freedom in 1947, the country got economic freedom only in 1991. The book that we are discussing today starts off at this watershed moment. In the afternoon of July 24, 1991, when then Finance Minister Manmohan Singh stood up in Parliament to present his maiden Union Budget speech. The speech went on to change the trajectory of the Indian economy, particularly its financial sector. Our guest on today's episode is senior journalist Raj Rishi Singhal. His book, Slip, Stitch and Stumble, narrates the story of financial sector reforms in India. Also joining me on this episode for this conversation with Raj Rishi is a special guest, one of Forbes India's very own journalists. Stay tuned. Welcome to From the Bookshelves, Raj Rishi. We are so happy to have you with us here today.
Thank you, Divya. Happy to be here.
And joining us on this episode today is my colleague Nasreen Sultana, who writes about financial markets for Forbes India. Hi, Nasreen.
Hi, Divya. Hi, Raj Rishi. Welcome.
Hi,
to the
Nasreen.
Show.
Thank you.
So, Raj Rishi and Nasreen have been colleagues in the past and they share a great rapport. So, I, for one, am really looking forward to a very engaging conversation. So, to get started, Raj Rishi, why is your book called Slip, Stitch and Stumble? Why do you think these three words best represent financial sector reforms in India?
Well, it represents the story of financial sector reforms, Divya. Basically, what the book says is how every time we try to do some kind of reforms in the financial sector, which is where, you know, it happened only when something slipped.
Yeah.
And then the reforms process was like a, you know, band-aid and plasters kind of a solution.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, temporary stitching that was done, little darning that happened, and then it was left to its devices. And then it, you know, you saw that stumbling all over again. And we saw this primarily in the equity markets, where the reforms process from start to finish took almost 10 years. For the basic element of the problem that plagued capital markets, equity capital markets, which is, you know, your badla trading, that took the regulators almost 10 years and two or three crises, you know, to sort it out.
Right. In fact, you know, we are heading into elections now, and, you know, like you just mentioned, you also say this in your book about how financial sector reforms, you know, have not been an electoral priority or talk point for any politician or leaders or leaders in general. And the general tendency in India towards financial reforms has been reactionary. So can you talk a little more about that?
Definitely, Divya. Yeah, so, you know, if you look at manifestos that have come out from various political parties in the past, I'm, you know, throwing my, you know, spreading my net wide here, and it includes almost every political party. Financial sector reforms are not really top of the agenda for them.
Right.
And given the, you know, socio-political structure of the economy, and, you know, how incomes are fraught and, you know, are unstable in vast sections of the population. I guess that, therefore, you know, by logic, logical extension, doesn't become of immediate priority or immediate, you know, attention for them. But their attention is drawn to financial sector reforms only when a crisis happens. And therefore, you know, In terms of the political campaigning process or the agenda that they draw up on the basis of which they campaign, very rarely includes financial sector reforms, because it doesn't appeal to the large, you know, proportion of the population. Expectations from the electorate is that you should have a financial sector that is clean, that is efficient, and that has minimal risk. Yeah, I mean, that this is like, you know, hygiene factor. Wherever we, you know, in whatever we do, we have minimum hygiene standards, and that is the expectation from the financial sector also.
Right.
And the the inability to provide that hygiene factor isn't really top of mind for most people, actually.
What kind of political compulsions have financial reforms faced? Could you give one or two examples? And how have you managed to strike a balance?
So if you look at, so one sector that immediately springs to mind is the public sector banks,
right?
So in the first flush of reforms in post 92, we gave out licenses for private sector banks, right? Now that licensing process is not very clear on what basis did the RBI grant those licenses. Because of that first bunch of licenses, very few private sector banks remain. Most of them have actually folded up or have been folded into the, you know, top three or four banks that exist today. So, you know, you have only IndusInd, you have HDFC, ICICI, and Axis. Axis used to be called UTI Bank. And IDBI is there, but IDBI, I don't think we should, you know, because IDBI is going to be sold and it's really in a bad shape. So, but most of the other private banks that were given licenses in that period were folded into these large banks. And a lot of these private banks have been subject to very close regulation from the Reserve Bank of India in terms of who their MD is supposed to be, who their directors are. Every little bit is checked and vetted by the regulator. But in a public sector bank, the government decides who will be the chairman, who will be the MD. And the RBI has very little say in, I mean, they do, you know, inform the RBI, and there is an informal process of getting the RBI's approval. But the RBI, to my mind, has very little say, or cannot, you know, veto the government's decision. It can veto a private bank's decision to appoint any executive. Famously, it also stepped in, you know, a few years ago to reduce the bonus given out to a CEO in a private bank. But it, so, you know, so the level of regulation between private bank and a public sector bank is different, is varied, right? And that, because the public sector banks are, you know, regulated, have twin regulation and dual regulation, actually, that is where politics creeps in. And the political economy plays out through the public sector, you know, who is appointed to the chair, who, you know, so their primary responsibility is to the government, not so much to the regulator. And that becomes a fertile ground for the, for, you know, political economy play.
There's one very recent change, or the financial reform, is the IBC and the NCLT, the resolution of the so-called defunct companies. What's your opinion now? Has the NCLT been able to resolve those cases, or is it that most companies are buying, and bigger companies are buying the smaller ones at a cheaper rates, and that's what is happening more than the resolution? Do you agree to that, or you have a different opinion?
See, I mean, it's all of that and then some more. Primarily, what has happened is we've seen the whole IBC process being diluted somewhat. And as a consequence, today, all the IBC cases take much longer, mostly on an average, take much longer than what was mandated earlier. On top of that, you have a quasi judicial system, the NCLT and the NCLAT, which suffer from capacity problems. They don't have enough judges, they don't have enough benches, they're overloaded with work, their training has not been up to the mark. In some cases, the Supreme Court has openly castigated the benches for poor quality of judgment and the poor quality of writing of the judgments, in fact. So that's the second process. You know, third is, you know, then the rest of the way in which the RPs and the Committee of Creditors operate, that third tier also needs to be improved. There is regulation required there on how you I mean, some of that is already happening, but it's an ongoing process, right? So in the meantime, your resolution cases that come to NCLT take much longer than what is required. In some cases, it's so long that the available, concern for the creditors in terms of value shrinks. Because as the days go on and it's an indebted company, the value keeps shrinking. It doesn't increase in value. So the, for what the creditors can get out of that concern reduces with every passing day. And so, one of the primary motives of the IBC and the IBB was to ensure that not all companies are liquidated. That the first opportunity should be to ensure that whether a company, given the, Indian's employment issues, its capital issues, that our first attempt should be to ensure that a company, whether we can revive the company or not. That should be the priority. If it can't be revived, then it should be liquidated. And that has happened in many cases. But this whole process of reviving the company is so caught up in this mm-hmm. process that when the creditors want to sell the organization as a going concern and recover their investment or their debt, they hardly recover, they're mm. recovering only a very short, small percentage of their original loan. Mm. So I think we need deep reforms in that process. And the second thing is that, again, as I've said in the book, the corporate sector has gamed that system also. The corporate sector has been gaming every solution that the government has brought to the table so far. I mean, it started with BIFR, then you had the, debt resolution tribunals, then you had the other mechanisms, and then now this. And every time, either the government dilutes the process or the corporates game the system.
Mm.
And the loser is actually the banking system and you and I, because, our money is in the banks and it is our taxes that are used to capitalize the banks. So the ordinary Indian suffers. But again, it doesn't reach the, political campaigning level because it's not part of the common consciousness.
Right. Can it become such, for example, towards the end of the book, you talk about, say, how financial inclusion is, still not a reality for a lot of people in this country. There is that whole aspect of poverty and deprivation that still needs to be solved. So, if financial reforms have to be, if people have to be made aware of financial reforms and if that has to become a priority, how do we first focus on taking financial inclusion to people or giving people that access to engage with it first?
Yeah, good question, Divya. Basically, financial inclusion hasn't really been all-encompassing. So we've only focused on opening bank accounts in everybody's names. And that doesn't necessarily mean, financial inclusion. And one is, critical adjunct for financial inclusion is to have employment or income generating abilities. Those, opportunities have not been, we don't still see those opportunities. And that is a big gap in financial inclusion. Second gap is, as I said, the unavailability of various savings products like micro pension, micro insurance. For a person who's at the border of the poverty line, for him to, be able to provide meals for himself and his other members of the household and then keep something for a rainy day, that will only happen when you have these micro solutions available to the person.
Right.
So financially, and therefore, because the person is not included financially in the system, the interest in financial sector reforms is minimal. It is, it's not top of the mind, actually.
Got it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question on the market regulation, because that's also part of the financial reforms. And last few months, and actually from 2020, we have seen a very aggressive regulator in the market. We have seen a lot of changes in terms of the IPO, the way the number of days being squeezed out, and the margin trading that was introduced just after the lockdown. Do you think the market regulator SEBI is going ahead of its time, where the market actually is not able to sync up to the new regulations, which is coming very fast pace, or you think that we are just as good, and as a country like India with new accounts opening up, this is actually the pace it should have been?
Well, I think some of the reforms or the regulatory measures that have been introduced were long overdue. For instance, in the derivatives markets, we've always had cash settlement, and I don't know why we. You know, when we introduced derivatives trading, F&O, in the year way back, we didn't insist on physical settlement, even though the report on which the F&O introduction was based had clearly said there should be not cash settlement, there should be physical settlement. And yet we decided to do cash settlement because it was meant for the speculators who needed an instrument to replace Badla. And so, right. I mean, if you look at the way whole sequencing of F&O was done in India, introduction of F&O, in very few countries do you have individual share futures introduced so early in the game. In most jurisdictions, you have index F&O first. Individual stock futures comes much later. And we did it right at the beginning because we needed to please the broking community. The broking community was very reluctant to let go of Badla trading. And so to replace and give them some other speculative product, we gave them individual share futures. And we allowed them to settle in cash instead of doing physical settlement. Now, after all, and there were many reports in the interim which kept saying that, we should do physical settlement, not do cash settlement. And now we finally did it after all these years. So a lot of the reforms were actually pending for many years. And if you see over the past 18 months, you look at just one stock exchange, you look at BSE, and you look at their index options and futures, the trading volume, in terms of value as well as volume, turnover has shot through the roof. And what's the reason?
And because that has got SEBI very worried, and still there is no change in the regulation at all.
Well, that's what SEBI is trying to do by bringing in margins, by asking brokers that you don't pay margin, your client has to pay margin, et cetera, right? I'm just trying to reduce the risk of the system.
Hmm.
And one of the problems is some of these guys who are introducing these chaps to the F&O market are fintechs, who are saying that you don't need any pay any brokerage, and it's so easy, and you borrow money, and which is why RBI has also got worried about the spike in retail lending, the unsecured retail lending, because a large part of that money is going into speculation in the markets, and that creates a systemic problem,
right,
and so therefore. I guess, SEBI thought that maybe the risk reward balance has shifted now. And therefore, the market needs hard regulation, needs to be, brought under stable conditions, because it had reached the precipice.
Right. But in the F&O segment, do you think there is room for more regulation? SEBI itself is saying that 9 out of 10 people are not making any money. They're actually losing money. And these are retail participants. And secondly, as you've mentioned, fintechs, that is with the use of your mobile phone, everybody can punch a trade. And then we have a set of influencers who are just giving you ideas every morning, saying that you can make 1,000 rupees or if you just spend 10 rupees. So there are a lot of segments which are making F&O very, very looking very lucrative. But actually, end of the day, people are losing money. But do you think the regulation needs to step in here and formalize some more tightening of the norms?
Yeah, I mean, I really can't say what more, you know, regulations are required. But yes, definitely. I think in terms of, you know, what is the messaging that is going out from the fintechs to the investors, that needs to change. That there needs to be very clear control on what they're promising to those investors, because, you know, a lot of the fintechs have promised investors that, you know, it's just money for jam. There are no losses, there are no risks. And, you know, then some of them are even guaranteeing returns, which is also illegal. So I think there's a whole bunch of stuff that can be done. And I think it needs a lot of close coordination between both SEBI and RBI. So, yes, I mean, I think there is room and scope for regulation. I'm not saying that, you know, stop the market, stop trading. I'm not saying, you know, put a halt to trading. All I'm saying is to keep the markets healthy, stable, and, you know, make sure that the F&O serves its purpose of as a platform for hedging your risks. Stop, you know, you may need to create some of those regulatory ring fences, perhaps.
Last question that I have is, looking forward at 24 and again, maybe 5 years down the line, what do you think, which are the key financial reforms do you think the government may or should be looking at in terms of tightening the norms or protecting the rights of investors, which are mostly in the retail segment?
So I think, right, protecting the rights of not just investors, but also depositors, right? Today, if you are a customer at a bank, any bank in India, for every little thing that you do, you have to produce Aadhaar, PAN, driving license, passport, every time. Now you ask the guy, where was the, you know, where's the PAN copy or the Aadhaar copy I gave you last time? He'll say, nahi, kahin to go down and pada hua hai. I need it again. Okay. And so these multiple copies of ID, you know, proof, we don't know where it's going, and it is subject to all kinds of misuse. Secondly, I think in the RBI has also been saying this, and these are very simple things, you know. So RBI has also been warning the banks against doing due diligence against their vendors, because a lot of the banking operations have been conducted by third parties, right? Not by the bank directly. So your call center is not run by the bank directly. It is contracted out to a third party.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your stuff is available to them.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very simple things. So one is, yes, depositor safety is very critical. But if you look at the five-year horizon, I would say on the, you know, big picture reforms that are required is, I think the tightening of the NPA system is definitely one. You need to do something to stop. I mean, you will always have NPAs. I'm not saying you'll have zero NPAs, because banking is a risk-based business. So there will always be some bank that, you know, or some business that collapses because of competition or whatever, obsolescence or whatever, right? So, but our problem in India has been willful defaults, when companies borrow and do not pay and siphon off the money.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be some kind of strict action against that. Second thing, I feel today there are too many people who are giving you loans without necessarily having the qualifications to do credit assessment, credit monitoring, or credit follow-up. You know, so like, let's say you have banks giving loans, right? So banks, because of the, you know, their structure, that because they've been giving loans for so many years, they have in-house structures for credit, which is, you know, built over the years on assessing a party's creditworthiness, looking at the details, and then monitoring that credit, you know, looking at his numbers, his operations, his performance. But now you have mutual funds giving credit. So do mutual funds have the necessary expertise? You have private equity giving credit. Private equity is supposed to, you know, I mean, you are. Whether they have that expertise. Secondly, because banks give out credit, they have to keep aside capital, risk-weighted capital. They have to do adequacy issues, right? Which mutual funds and PEs don't have to do. So, you know, automatically you put banks on an uneven field. Their cost of credit goes up. And I think that should be sorted out because there is inter-regulator issues here because mutual funds are part of SEBI. You know, PE is also a part of SEBI's jurisdiction. And the third one is, you know, how do you get companies to borrow from the bond market? So can we have a robust corporate bond market? And that has been, you know, again, work in progress for the last 30, 35 years. We haven't still got a robust corporate bond market. So I think these three issues primarily are.
Thank you so much for your time, Raj Rishi. Thank you.
Thank you, Divya. Thank you, Nasreen. Thank you for having me on the show.
So that was me and my colleague Nasreen Sultana discussing Raj Rishi Singhal's book Slip, Stitch and Stumble, which is about the financial sector reforms in India. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I am Divya Shekhar. See you next time.